breakthroughs.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the wake of the violence perpetrated by terrorists on the journalists at Charlie Hebdo in Paris, people in the West have been proclaiming that the victims had simply been practicing a principle we hold dear: freedom of speech. But the terrorists and other like-minded individuals considered it hate speech. And according to the New York Times columnist David Brooks, if we're honest with ourselves, some in this country might too. He writes, let's face it, if the journalist at Charlie Hebdo tried to publish their satirical newspaper on any American university campus of the last two decades, it wouldn't have lasted 30 seconds. Student and faculty groups would have accused them of hate speech. The administration would have cut financing and shut them down. So let's spend an hour exploring that. When does satire become hate speech? If one of the tenets of responsible journalism is to minimize harm, how should we react when groups or individuals feel harmed by what we publish or put on the air? Kevin Sires is the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Charlotte Observer, a job he has held since 1987. His work is distributed nationwide by King Features Syndicate and has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Newsweek, and USA Today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Kimberly Lawson is the editor of Creative Loafing Charlotte, and prior to taking that position, she had the unenviable job of being a copy editor there for 9 years, a tough job. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks.
And Craig Paddock is a lecturer in the Department of Communication Studies at UNC Charlotte, where he teaches undergraduate courses in journalism, including media ethics. He also worked for 20 years as a copy editor at the Charlotte Observer. Thank you for joining us, too.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the question of when free speech becomes hate speech has been around for a long time, but it was horrifically brought back in Paris recently. Charlie Hebdo was a satirical magazine. Does satire fall under the same code of ethics that journalism might? Well, you're the satirical cartoonist, so go ahead and take
it. I work for journalists, so it falls under what I publish follows under their guidelines, I guess. But I don't think I have the same concerns, obviously, because what I'm putting in the paper is my opinion. I don't have to worry about things like objectivity or fairness. In fact, when critics say, well, this editorial cartoon was unfair, it's sort of like a tautology. That's what a cartoon is. What satire is a distortion, almost like it's a lie to tell a truth. And what the editorial cartoonist tries to do is to be honest and call the shots the way he sees them. And the other concerns that the reporters have to follow are sort of secondary.
Plus, Charlie Hebdo was not a newspaper. It was a satirical magazine, not unlike Mad Magazine, which their whole job is to make fun of things, good and bad, and exaggerate. So do publications which are part of the media, like Mad Magazine, have any responsibilities in terms of not hurting people through what they do?
Well, they certainly have responsibility. Charlie Hebdo called itself, in fact, a mean, stupid newspaper. But they still have the responsibility to try to minimize harm even in the way they do it. You know, journalism and satire is very different. Like Kevin said, journalism tries to be fair. Journalists try to accumulate a bunch of evidence and make a reasoned decision. And Kevin's cartoons and other people who are satirists try not to be fair. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not fair. They're trying to make a point. And that's what satire is. You know, it's the use of humor, irony, ridicule, exaggeration.
Song parody.
To make a point.
We have three journalists here at the table, and freedom of speech extends beyond journalism. Although journalism or journalists should probably be truthful and be accountable and act independently and try to do no harm, freedom of speech can counteract all of those things, can it not? I mean, you don't have to be in a country where you believe in freedom of speech. You don't have to adhere to any of those things, do you, as an individual? Kimberly?
Well, I mean, journalists, freedom of speech is the cornerstone that we stand on. We have to be able to point out when politicians are doing wrong. We have to be able to put out criticism that makes people think.
Mm-hmm. But even with freedom of speech, we have certain curtailments on it. There's that old rule that, you can say anything you want to, but you don't yell fire in a crowded theater. Should we be inflaming? Do you have to keep that in the back of your mind as a journalist, that perhaps what you're writing or drawing or putting out there might inflame an already hot situation? Is that a consideration?
Well, freedom of the press is not the freedom to do whatever you want. That used to be the thinking years ago, but as journalists turned into a mass medium affecting a lot of people, having a huge audience, wielding a good bit of power, there was the idea of social responsibility, that you have more to do than just please yourself or, in the case of a news organization, to make money. You have a responsibility to do some good. So a First Amendment freedom we see now is the freedom to do good, to not have barriers put in by the government to keep you from doing what you ought to do. It's never been a freedom to do whatever you want.
Well, back in the day of William Randolph Hearst and Pulitzer, when they were running New York newspapers and there were 10 or 15 New York daily papers every single day, morning and afternoon, the only way they could distinguish themselves was to be rather incendiary and inflammatory and talk about things that were not unlike, I guess, the difference between MSNBC and Fox News. They would say things that were not necessarily true or exaggerations of the truth just simply to sell newspapers. When did we get this idea in this country that that was the wrong thing to do, that we had to be upright and upstanding and completely truthful and objective? And has that changed now?
Well, I think people – we tend to think that journalism kind of grew up in the 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. 70s. The famous Hutchins Commission set out several rules for what journalists ought to do, provide a forum for debate, to be representative of the community. And this was a commission that the founder of Times or the owner of Times set up. And he didn't put any journalists on the committee. And so, predictably, journalists roundly dismissed the conclusions of the Hutchins Commission. But over time, these ideas started to work their way into the journalist's way of thinking. And I don't think you could find a journalist now who doesn't agree with the main points of what the Hutchins Commission said.
The role of a newspaper like Creative Loafing is very different from the role of a Charlotte Observer or a Washington Post or a New York Times. You're kind of a scrappy newspaper that does a lot of opinion columns, some news, some police blotter stuff, lots of entertainment, etc. Do you see your what you have to get out there with something that makes people want to read it? So you do have a lot of opinion columns with strong opinions, and sometimes opinions that go against the grain, I would think, of a lot of people who, in this city.
Right.
Is that a consideration? Is that deliberate?
Yeah. As an alt-weekly, we have to stand apart somehow. So we generally, alt-weeklies will lean a little more liberal.
Mm-hmm.
We're very voice-driven. Alt-weeklies were started as an alternative to the mainstream news media. And so we kind of have to find a different route. Nowadays, though, there's social media, there's blogs. And so we've struggled a little bit to find that different path. But we still have – but the way we can distinguish ourselves from blogs is we hold true to the integrity of journalism.
Mm-hmm. Do you get a lot of complaints about what people write in your paper, your columnist?
Oh, we get some.
Do you give them voice, the people who write in?
We used to run a letters to the editor section. Through the recession, we've had to cut back on space, and so we no longer have that in the paper. But people are more than welcome to comment on the website.
Of course, freedom of speech also means freedom of expression, and I would think, although when you draw a cartoon, there may be a slug line in it, it's not necessarily speech, it's expression, and you are putting forth an opinion. The basis of real comedy, for me at least, is truth, an exaggerated truth perhaps, but truth. So does comedy, does satire get a pass when it's in terms of being responsible?
Well, I guess that's what makes it good. If it's not true, it's not good, and it's a waste of time to do it. And I think each cartoonist, each satirist has his own standards of what's true and what's not. But I mean, that's really what you're trying to aim for, is to is to make a point that you're trying to expose something, and get at something that's hidden. If a government official is obfuscating about something, you want to strip that away. You want to expose it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very much, you know, it's an old cliche, but the little kid who points at the king and says this guy's not wearing any clothes. I mean, that's our basic job, mm-hmm. and so we're impolite, we're rude. You know, we're sometimes we just can't resist throwing a snowball and knocking off a top hat. But basically, our job is to tell people that there's something there that they're not seeing, and satire is the tool to get them to see it.
What got Charlie Hebdo into trouble is that their depiction. Did you want to talk about that?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think some of the best cartoons that Kevin has done, you know, we would get – I laid out the editorial pages sometimes, and I'd look at it and say, oh, man, I can't believe Kevin said this. Yeah. I wonder if he's going to be able to get away with that. You know, and that's what a cartoonist does. You know.
Well, one of the thing that got Charlie Hebdo into trouble was the fact that they drew a picture of Muhammad. And we all know – we cannot excuse the acts of these terrorists, but we all know that drawing a picture of Muhammad is forbidden in Islam, and people find it very offensive and perhaps even sacrilegious in some cases. So is that something that journalists and cartoonists have to take into consideration, that they really are breaking a taboo, at least in certain areas? And it may not just be with Islam. It could be with anything. That you're breaking a taboo and that's going to cause a problem. Is that a consideration?
It's a consideration. It's more a consideration for my editors than it is for me. I mean, I really and was told when I started at the Observer and worked at the Observer that not to worry about censoring myself. That's what I have layers of upper management for, to get to decide what can I get away with.
Do they reject cartoons?
Yes, they have.
Based on?
Sometimes it's based on taste. Sometimes it's based on whether or not they think someone's going to understand the point I'm trying to make. There's been very rare occasions where they simply have said, you know, this is too far, you can't say that. But I can't even think of an example of that. The Observer's been great, and my editorial page editor I had, Ed Williams. One time, a newspaper in the Knight Ridder Corporation was killing cartoons out because they didn't want to upset the Justice Department on some issue. I guess it was back in the Reagan administration. And Ed Meese was a target, and they were pulling their punches for some reason. And Ed came up to me and said, look, you know, this is not what you do with a cartoonist. You need to
– Ed Williams came up to
Ed Williams came – I'm sorry. Excuse me. Not Ed Meese. Ed Williams came up to me and said, this is not what, you know, cartooning should be about. We need to send a message to the corporation. I want you to draw the most offensive cartoon you can think of. And at the time, there was a family in Charlotte who were street evangelists, and they had their children out.
Yes.
And the children were, like, proselytizing with the parents, and the people would pass by, and the little child would cry, whoremonger, to the passerbys, and just freaking people out. And so I did a cartoon of Jesus saying, suffer the little children, come unto me, with a little child standing next to him. And the next panel, a kid looks up and goes, whoremonger! And they published it. So, I mean, with a background like that, I don't feel like there's a lot that I really have to worry about censoring myself.
Talking about free speech and when it becomes hate speech and how you handle that, particularly if you're in the media, but also we'll talk about how you handle that in real life, because we have a free speech tradition in this country, and we all take advantage of it and sometimes over advantage of it. Kevin Sires is here, Kimberly Lawson and Craig Paddock. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Talk It Out NC, an initiative that gives parents tools for talking to kids about the dangers of underage drinking. Details at talkitoutnc.org. And Alta Vista Wealth Management, providing personal investment strategies, financial planning, and advice. Lorraine Eason has more information at 704-365-4867 or altavistawealth.com. Well, as we near Valentine's Day, we start seeing those little hearts everywhere, you know, little red hearts. And that's because for centuries, humans believe the heart to be the seat of the soul and the origin of love and emotion. Of course, the real heart is the center of our being, as long as it's beating. And if we're lucky, it beats about 2.5 billion times over the course of a lifetime. We're going to take a fascinating journey through what we know about the heart with an evolutionary biologist tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama is asking Congress for legal authority to use military force against ISIS. Debate over when and how the U.S. military can be used, and whether Congress should limit the scope of operations.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Kevin Sires, editorial cartoonist at the Charlotte Observer, Kimberly Lawson, editor of Creative Loafing, and Craig Paddock, journalism and ethics lecturer at UNC Charlotte and former copy editor for the Charlotte Observer as well. Do you think that satire sometimes goes too far? Do journalists and media outlets have a responsibility to be sensitive to religious or political groups? Give us your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter or at Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. As a cartoonist, when you know something is going to be absolutely patently offensive, particularly to a religious group like Islam, or even if you know that the cartoon you draw objectifies women, for instance. I was trying to think last night of something equally offensive to drawing Muhammad, and I couldn't come up with something. So objectifying women was the only thing I could come up with. Do you try to tell your story in a different way? If you know it's offensive, can you be funny? Can you make your point? Do you try to do so in a different way?
You know, it's all about communication, and the idea, the cartoon, the intent of a cartoon is not simply to offend. It's to get a point across. And if the image you use gets in the way of getting your point across, then you've got to go and find an image that works better. A lot of times, though, the offensiveness is collateral damage. I mean, you want to have a strong image because you want the cartoon to have impact. You want to get people's attention. You want to make your point as dramatic as possible. And there's no telling who's going to take offense at what. Sometimes you think this cartoon, you know, there's sometimes I've done a cartoon that's simply a throwaway that I think this is just a cute little thing, won't offend anybody. For instance, several years ago when Cam Newton was having all his problems, but yet he still insisted on ripping open his shirt to do the Superman thing. I did a cartoon where he rips open his shirt, instead of the S for Superman, there's a Hello Kitty logo. and I thought, well, this is just a silly little cartoon, and I just thought it was funny. And turns out, you know, the people on ESPN made a huge issue out of it, and turns out the cartoon was accused of racism and this, that, and the other thing. I think all those criticisms were off base. But at the same time, I never thought that cartoon would offend professional football fans, but apparently it did.
They're not as tough as they look.
Huh? Yeah.
Kimberly, same question from a writing point of view, because you publish a lot of opinion columns, and I think you publish a few humor columns along the way, and humorists sometimes offend people with their comedy. Do you encourage people to take a different slant if you think this is going to be tremendously offensive to somebody?
I've not personally come across any columns that have been really offensive. When I edit columns, I look to make sure that the point is very clear. Mm-hmm. Recently, we did a story on right after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, where I talked to a bunch of illustrators, cartoonists, and asked them to submit work. And one guy submitted a cartoon that was really offensive, and I chose not to publish it. And I mentioned in the story that this artist sent us something and we chose not to publish it. It was pretty graphic. And I think the message, it had a strong message, but the message wasn't clear. Mm-hmm. So I think in anything we do editorially, we have to be sure that the message that we intend, whether it's to offend or whether it's to criticize or to shed light on something, that it's you know, elucidated.
Where would the ethicist fall on this? What would you say to your students about this?
Well, you know, journalists have the responsibility to do good. They have the responsibility to think, how would a reasonable person react to this cartoon or to this potentially offensive material? And they need to take that into account. That can't be their guide. But, you know, the problem with looking at, you know, what is the reaction is going to be is that you can't determine the reaction. As Kevin, you know, showed us with the Hello Kitty cartoon, yeah. You can't forecast how people are going to react, how they're going to take offense, what they're going to take offense at.
I would think that for a cartoonist, what happened in Paris had to have been beyond shocking. What was your reaction to it?
I came across the news just shortly after I got to work and turned on my computer and catching up with things and saw this come across. And I'm just in my office and I'm going, oh, no, oh, no. And finally my coworkers had asked me, what's wrong? What's going on? And, I mean, it was just really a blow to the gut. Mm-hmm. I didn't know these cartoonists, but at the same time it felt like someone had attacked my family. I mean, it's a small group of people.
Yeah, there are not many cartoonists in the world, I would think.
No, no. And
at least published cartoonists.
Right. Cartoonists are making money at it. There's a lot of people who draw.
Yeah.
But so it was very personal. And then your second reaction is, well, you've got to do something. And then you spend the rest of the day figuring out what that is.
What about this? I mean, did you react? Does it make you second-guess yourself? I mean, does it make cartoonists, when things like this happen, or journalists of any stripe, re-examine their thought process what you do when you look at a piece of finished work? Should I do this? Should I not publish this? Should I turn it in? Should I not turn it in? Does it make you second guess yourself?
My reaction, and from what I've been able to ascertain from my colleagues in the field, as we've written about this and talked about this both in the press and amongst ourselves, is that it's made us even more determined to do strong cartoons. Instead of second guessing, we're more determined to be bold. And several cartoonists' reactions to the shooting was to draw Muhammad and put Muhammad in a cartoon somehow condemning the killers.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of holding back, I think a lot of people went forward to do even more bold work.
The trouble with drawing Muhammad is you don't know he's Muhammad unless you label him, because there are no artistic drawings of Muhammad or paintings of Muhammad.
Right, and it also gives you an out. Marlette did this infamous cartoon once, was What Would Muhammad Drive? And it had a bearded guy in a turban in an armored car. And, of course, that created a huge furor because, obviously, the implication is that's Muhammad driving the car. But then Marlette said, oh, no, that's just some guy driving it.
Right. Because I read that you worry about more about whether or not a cartoon goes far enough.
Right. There's all kinds of ways to do a weak cartoon, and you don't want to do that if you can possibly help it.
Can you do your job without offending someone? I mean, I would think somebody every day is offended by something you draw.
I think it's in the job description. I'm sure Governor McCrory thinks that I do hate speech daily.
Yeah, and you know. Kevin's one of the nicest guys you want to meet. I mean, and that's one of the effective things about satire, is that it causes us to see our own folly and vices and draws us in. It engages us. It makes us laugh at it. You know, when Jon Stewart is being very playful in his satire, he's incredibly effective.
Mm. And yet we do draw lines. It's not as though anything gets into the newspaper or on television or on the radio. There are people like copy editors and editors-in-chief and editorial page editors and program directors. And there's a whole phalanx of people who are gatekeepers, essentially. And lines are drawn. Who decides where the line is? Does the line move? How do we know what the line is? Or where it is?
That's a very difficult question.
I know,
of course.
That's why you're here, to answer it.
The line moves every day.
Don't give them any ideas now, Craig.
I think the line does move based on circumstances, based on society's shift in ideals. But I don't think it moves as much as we think it does. I think we as a society decide what's appropriate and what is not. I think it's interesting about the Charlie Hebdo attacks. You know, most respectable people, and I hate to make a generalization here, but most respectable people probably would not be caught dead reading Charlie Hebdo, at least in this country. I mean, there's some pretty disgusting things that they did. It's a horribly tragic thing that happened over there. But, you know, you don't want this to be a test case for offensive speech in journalism. They, you know, as I said before, they saw themselves as a mean, stupid magazine, and you know, they equally offended everyone.
But I mean, when you draw a line, when you say this is the line we won't cross, it's a standard that we uphold either at our publication or universally throughout the world of journalism. I'm not sure that's even possible. Is it done so on the basis of taste, good taste? Is it done so on the basis of some sort of sensitivity? Are you considering who your audience is, either your readership or your viewers or your listeners? What goes into making up that decision?
I think it's a combination of all those things. So at Creative Loafing, you know, our audience is going to be different than the audience at the Charlotte Observer, so we can push buttons a little more. Do I still get angry emails and Facebook posts? Yes, I do. But I've learned that we can't make everyone happy. Mm-hmm. Taste is a big part of it.
Is that a you know, you mentioned, Kimberly, a little while ago, the rise of blogs and independent thought on the internet. As a publication, be it The Observer or The New York Times or Creative Loafing or NBC News, for that matter, when you draw these lines in the sand and you say, this is our standard, this is where we will go and no further, at least today, are you spitting into the wind? Because people on the internet will take it much further than you will take it, and that is getting out, and people are seeing it and reading it, and therefore sensibilities are being changed. And I guess the question is, do you feel it's silly in this day and time to have any standards, to draw any lines?
Well, I think you are still the moral agent. You, as a moral agent, you are called on to make a judgment call. You cannot account for all the changing circumstances or what other people will do. You have to do what you believe is right. And there's a wonderful line and from the Project of Excellence about journalists must be able to follow their own conscience. And that's what that means here. You cannot be a gatekeeper anymore, as you just pointed out. You know, if you don't publish a horribly graphic photo, people will get it on the internet somehow. But what you can do is say, we are not going to publish that. We are going to have these standards. And it's a decision you make based on news value. It's a decision you make based on the understanding of your audience, what they will take and what they won't take. It's also you also have business considerations because your credibility is at stake. And if you don't publish the photo, someone else will. And so you have to say, am I willing to make that call where, yes, I may look like I don't know what's going on, I'm not aware of the existence of this photo, but this is something we just don't show our audience.
The Charlie Hebdo incident plays right into that because most mainstream newspapers wouldn't print the cartoons, but wouldn't print the covers. But yet anyone who wanted to see it can go on to the internet,
right,
and you know it's there for the world to see. So I guess part of the news value is, you know, there was no need for the mainstream press to print it because they were content to be scooped by the internet.
When you draw a cartoon and you're trying to be satirical, how do you know if what you've drawn is truly satirical or just being unreasonably mean to someone or something? And I know you've talked about this is your opinion, so you do have an agenda when you draw these cartoons. How do you know that your agenda is a fair agenda, if that is even a consideration?
I mean, I just, you know, the only way, if I'm feeling false about it, then I would consider that, you know, that obviously I'm just doing this to be mean. But if I really, you know, so you got to, you know, check your emotions, check your gut. I mean, if I really think that this is true, then you go with it.
So if somebody above you says, we can't publish that, I mean, you thought you submitted it because you thought this is a legitimately satirical comment on the news of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody says, we can't print that, or we're not going to print that because it goes too far, or it does this, or it does that. Is that a gut check, or is that just simply a difference of opinion, and they're the boss, and so, okay, fine, we won't run that. Well, I'll do something else.
Yeah. I mean, they pay my salary. They get to make those choices. That's their job. I'm doing my job by pushing against it. They get, you know, they do their job by deciding the limits. And I've long got past the point of throwing a temper tantrum, or you know, sulking about it. It's like, well, okay, back to the drawing board.
Right.
It's just a reality.
In an article, Kimberly, that you published about the Paris murders, you quote Greg Russell, who is a graphic designer and a cartoonist for the Charlotte Business Journal, as saying he has no desire to offend anyone, because that means, this is a quote, that just means you're mocking one group of haters' beliefs and shoring up another group of haters' beliefs. It perpetuates an us versus them attitude, which is always dangerous and a lie. Does he have a point?
I think he does. I definitely think he does. I mean, he's also a cartoonist. He's entitled to his opinion. What he puts out there into the world has his name on it, and he's got to feel good about it.
Does he have a point from a journalist's point of view, from a print or a word journalist's point of view?
You never set out to offend anyone. I mean, good satire aims to make a point, not just to be snarky or juvenile. But you know, you can't let the possible offense keep you from your conscience, from doing what you believe is
but
right.
But not all people in journalism and not all people in the world are as thoughtful or as talented as a Kevin Sayers or some of the writers that you publish who have opinions and well-thought-out opinions in creative loafing. Some people are just shooting from the hip and they're being jackasses. Or they're just snarky and they think they're being incredibly insightful and funny when in fact they are being offensive. And that is freedom of speech, but it is also hate speech.
And we expect more from our journalists.
You're talking Facebook now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or any of those comments that used to run after articles in The Observer. I mean, I don't know if you still do that on your internet site or not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Some of the comments that were anonymous were blistering.
As journalists, we used to think, this is going to be a great tool, allowing comments after articles. We're going to be able to get fresh, new perspective. We're going to keep the conversation going. Build new sources. This will be a great tool for furthering our understanding. And it's just amazing how that's changed. It's turned out to be a cesspool out
yes.
there, as you know. I mean, it's...
And some publications, I don't know if The Observer has done this or not, but some publications have cut that off. They mm-hmm. Or they've said, okay, you can continue to post, but you cannot post anonymously. Well, why not? It's freedom of speech.
There's a certain... you have to take responsibility for what you say. And people, if you don't have to take responsibility for what you say, if you don't have to put your name behind something, then you're going to be really irresponsible. It's just, it's just not gutsy to do that. You know, you need to be a person who says, this is what I believe and, this is who I am.
Mm. Stan Lee, the creator of Spider-Man, had this creed that I've believed in since I was 6 years old and read this issue, where, with great power comes great responsibility. And that's sort of the cartoonist creed.
The average citizen thinks about that when they open their mouth to speak, that we have this great power with our ability to have free speech in this country and in most of the West. We're not curtailed in what we can say. But do we consider that? Do we think about our responsibility not to be deliberately, outlandishly offensive when we speak?
I think you know the answer to that, right?
Yes, I do.
We don't. I mean, as journalists, we don't. We are trained to be responsible. Think our words have consequences.
And we have to stop. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, serving Charlotte for over 30 years with fine diamonds, engagement rings, and jewelry for all occasions. Donald Hack Diamonds, Morrowcroft Shopping Village at Colony and Sharon Road, and at DonaldHack.com. President Obama is asking Congress for legal authority to use military force against ISIS. Debate over when and how the U.S. military can be used and whether Congress should limit the scope of the operations is the topic of the conversation coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can reach us via email, charlottetalks at WFAE.org, or on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE. And we're coming right back.
People have many ways to dance around the topic of death.
Europe? I mean the ultimate long vacation.
Yeah, Ritzy, eventually we're all going to take the same long vacation.
If you're not sure how to talk about dying or how to plan for end-of-life medical care, join WFAE for a public conversation Thursday evening at the Levine Center for the Arts. Details on this free community forum are at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Kevin Sires, editorial cartoonist with the Charlotte Observer, Kimberly Lawson, editor of Creative Loafing Charlotte, and Craig Paddock, a journalism and ethics lecturer at UNC Charlotte and former copy editor for the Observer, about freedom of speech and the responsibilities that come with it. Bill from Matthews writes in, I worked in network TV back in the late 1980s, a few years after Walter Cronkite's fitting observation about the journalistic damage done as news becomes entertainment. Seems like today's news is mostly entertainment. I think he's talking about television. I still remember some of the buzz phrases from my days in the post-Cronkite news business. If it bleeds, it leads. If there is no crisis, that's a crisis. It's sad when everything is breaking news, when an in-depth feature is less than 2 minutes long, when too much time is spent in self-promotion. So let's talk about this. We do live in a celebrity culture, and a lot of news is gravitating toward covering celebrities and their shenanigans versus the news that really affects the rest of us. Also, freedom of speech. We have this paparazzi culture that has grown up to cover these celebrities to the point where a lot of celebrities really have no life. These people follow them around. They're there all the time. They can't walk outside of their house to get the newspaper without these people taking responsibility. And they're only doing it because media outlets will pay them for the pictures that they take or the stories that they deliver. Is that being responsible?
Well, this is called checkbook journalism, where you pay people to give you a photo or to give you an interview. And most journalists frown on that. You don't pay a source because that changes what the source says. You know, if I give someone $20, they're going to want me to get my money's worth. And so there's always that temptation to make the information they're giving me better rather than have it be the truth. So I think most standard news organizations don't follow that practice, though CNN has done that, I believe, a couple years ago.
But I guess what I want to get to is rights. Freedom of speech we consider to be a right, but sometimes that freedom hurts other people. And obviously going out and getting a photograph of Tom Cruise picking up the paper on his front lawn or doing something else that might be a newsmaker is a right, I suppose. But do the celebrities have rights? Is there a hierarchy of rights that we have to consider in the media?
There are rights and there are duties. You have a right to do a lot of things. You have a duty, an ethical obligation to consider other people. And yes, there is a different line for celebrities. We are enormously interested in what they do. I'm not sure Tom Cruise is hurt too much if we show a picture of him getting the newspaper, though that's his prerogative.
Or coming out of a restaurant with somebody you're not married to. And the implication is that you're having an affair. You may not be.
Well, there's a difference between a celebrity and an unwilling participant in the news. You know, these celebrities, they have publicists to get them in the news. So actors, actresses, entertainers, politicians, even athletes have kind of sought out that celebrity status. What really becomes a problem is when there is an unwilling subject of news. Someone has just lost a loved one. In Afghanistan, say, and they become a person of public interest, even though they don't want to be. You know, they have a different expectation of privacy.
I want to get back to this column that the New York Times printed by David Brooks that I quoted in the very beginning of the show that talks about universities would not have put up with the kind of material that was published by that magazine in Paris. It wouldn't fly on a college campus because it would have been deemed hate speech, he wrote. I don't know if he's right about that, but there are certainly examples of publications on college campuses being shut down or censored across this country. There have been examples of professors being shut down and censored. Bill Maher says that ABC took him off the air several years ago when he was doing a show called Politically Incorrect because of something he said. Can we claim that free speech trumps the concerns of others when we don't practice it fully? We don't.
I guess that's the marketplace of ideas. I mean, everyone wants free speech for
themselves.
For themselves, and the people who say that we need to be tolerant are sometimes the most intolerant people of all. I did a cartoon back when I was working for a campus newspaper back in the early 80s. These two feminist intellectuals, Catherine McKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, had come to the city council and wanted them to pass an ordinance outlawing pornography because it was a violation of women's civil rights. And there was a lot of debate about whether that was a good point or not. And the newspaper decided that it was really a First Amendment issue and not a civil rights issue. And so I did a cartoon of McKinnon and Dworkin dressed up as Puritans with little hatchets in their hand. And this was a very college cartoon, but it was, I did a little poem. McKinnon and Dworkin took an axe and gave pornography 40 whacks. And when they saw what they had done, they gave the First Amendment 41. Well, I had put the cartoon in the paper, you know, thought that was a great cartoon. Early the next morning, I came down to the journalism building, and our office in the newspaper was in the basement, and plastered up on the wall all along the length of the newspaper office were these sanitary napkins with red letters on each napkin spelling out "Stop the hateful misogynist cartoons" or something like that. And then there was a demonstration on campus, and it was actually very exciting.
let's expand on that, because when the media prints or airs something unpopular, some opinion that offends somebody, especially in the aftermath of terrible events like 9/11 or the Charlie Hebdo murders, they catch flack for publishing that opinion from some people. Because some people have come out to defend what happened in Paris in a way, not completely, not the murderous aspect, but the fact that they offended people through those cartoons. Those complaints come, at least in this country, from a lot of ordinary citizens who believe in free speech, and yet they are saying, stop this, don't print this, don't say this, don't let them say this. Do we really believe in free speech? Do we really?
What we really believe in are sacred images, and there's no image more sacred than the image you have of yourself. You're a good person. The things you believe in are right and true. And when someone confronts you and says, that's not so, people get angry about it.
Well, look at the political debate.
Right.
You lecture, I think, Craig, that you lecture on the difference between a journalist's right to offend and their duty to do no harm, part of the journalistic code. How do you determine that if you're a journalist? How do you know that you're doing your job and you're not harming people? Because you have to say some things that might harm people.
Yeah, I think you have to determine what the news value is, what the point of something is that you're trying to make. And it's critical thinking that journalists do all the time. I mean, journalists should be really good at journalism ethics because they are constantly practicing critical thinking. They're evaluating the world around them that they see. They're evaluating information that they have, and they're deciding is this worth it? You know, and that's something we all do when we take a risk. We ask ourselves, is this worth the risk to me? And so I think it becomes magnified because journalists speak to a mass audience. And so we somehow hold them up to a different standard. But I think it's the same standard we have for ourselves.
As you're editing all these opinion columns in Creative Loafing, does that come into your mind? Are these people saying what we're allowing them to say on our pages, are they harming others?
I do think about that. When it comes to free speech, I think we want to believe we love free speech, but I think we don't think about outside factors. So as the editor of a newspaper, I want to champion the various voices that we've chosen to print in our publication. But I'm also having to think about, are these criticisms targeting a specific advertiser, and am I going to get flack from my sales manager? And there are a lot of different factors that I don't think people really consider. I mean, we want to champion free speech, but...
Because in our daily lives, we have freedom of speech. We probably don't think about it much, but I don't think we also self-censor a lot, although there are times that we do, simply out of politeness or because we don't want to inflame a situation. We're maybe at lunch with people who have different political views, and somebody says something we find remarkably offensive, and we make a snap judgment. Should I challenge that, or should I just let it go because we're having lunch and it's, I don't want to spoil the afternoon? We make those decisions. Does the media?
I think they do. I mean, there are lots of layers of editors, of gatekeepers. You know, it's not in journalists' best interest to offend. It costs journalists something when they offend their readers. It doesn't cost them a whole lot, frankly. People may say they're going to cancel their subscription over a Kevin Sayers cartoon, but I don't think Kevin is responsible for the economic troubles.
Advertisers might cancel over a Kevin Sayers cartoon. Is that a consideration?
I don't think it ever has been. Has it, Kevin?
Not that I know of. Okay. But that I don't know. I mean,
well, there is that firewall that you may not be told about it.
And I appreciate that firewall, too.
I mean, you know, when journalists start to take business considerations into account, you know, they kind of lose their reason for being.
Well, that's the
they have to do that.
That's the publisher's job, not the editorial staff, right?
Yes.
Right, exactly. You want to have freedom of speech, and you champion it, and you hide behind it. You know, you have to follow those principles through, and you can't let the almighty dollar be the bottom line.
So if some people are offended by free speech, whether it's in a newspaper article or whether it's in a political cartoon or whether it's on television, is that then hate speech? If I'm offended by your free speech, is that hate speech? And if it's not, what is hate speech?
Hate speech is a convenient label to shut people up. I mean, really. You can't – I mean, if people are offended by opinion, then – I'm sorry. People – what I mean is people aren't harmed by someone else's opinion. If you're a mature adult, you can say, okay, well, that's your opinion, but you're an idiot, which is also free speech. I mean –
there's an old saying, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That's not true. Words do hurt.
Yeah, I mean that's certainly true, and you know journalists need to realize the effect of their words. They also need to realize the power of their words to do good, and it's a two-way street there.
One example of hate speech that I can think of right off the top of my head, it was several decades ago they had the Nazi march in Skokie, Illinois, and undoubtedly what those people were doing was hate speech because they were, engaging in these stereotypes and berating a group of people, But at the same time, that was First Amendment protected speech. They had a right to march. They had a right to say those things, even though no one thinks that that was a no one thinks that what they were saying was true.
So this the quote that I used in the opening minute that we didn't hear in the studio is attributed to Voltaire, and I don't know that he actually said
several this, others too.
Yeah, several others too. I disagree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. Does that include hate speech?
Yes. I don't know how to expound on that, but yes.
And if we say no, does that mean we don't believe in free speech?
How do you draw the line? How do you delineate what is hate and what is simply strong speech? I once had a student tell me that he thought all editorial cartoons were hate speech, and you can't really do anything with that. It's just somebody is going to be drawing those lines, and who do you let draw the lines? It seems like the remedy is more speech. And I know that, doesn't always work in society because there's all these market forces that determine what gets said and what gets trumpeted. But at the same time, it's the only way that I can really figure out how to make it work.
A Twitter comment, satire often depends on satirizing those with more power, not less. The other way around is seen as bullying.
Right. That's an old, the whole idea of a satirist should punch up and not punch down. Again, but everyone who gets punched sees themselves as a victim, whether it's the governor or the president or a religious group.
Ed Williams, who you've quoted here, who is a former editorial page editor for the Charlotte Observer and a WFAE board member, has emailed us to say, when I was the Observer's editorial page editor and overseeing cartoonists, my intent was that a cartoon shouldn't defend anyone unintentionally. The point of a cartoon usually is to poke fun at or even ridicule people because of something they'd done. When people called in to complain about a cartoon, I wanted to be able to explain why I thought it was a valid comment. So focus and clarity were important. I also didn't believe cartoons shouldn't poke fun at God or Jesus or Muhammad. It was their followers who were causing the problem, often in direct contradiction of the teachings of their faith. Some of Kevin's best cartoons on religious topics pointed out that people who called themselves Christians had an odd way of following Christ.
I love Ed. I mean, that's exactly when we would use religious imagery in a cartoon at the Observer, it was, I mean, I don't think I would draw Muhammad to make fun of Muslims, or I wouldn't draw Jesus to make fun of Christians, but you draw that to compare and contrast the teachings versus the followers.
Well, I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of this. It's an impossible topic to unravel, but I'm glad we had the discussion. Kevin Sires is the editorial cartoonist for the Charlotte Observer. Craig Paddock is a journalism and ethics lecturer, ethics and journalism lecturer, I should say, at UNC Charlotte, and a former copy editor for the Charlotte Observer. And Kimberly Lawson is editor of that subversive publication, Creative Loafing Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you.